You're listening to Harrismith Radio. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode of Harrismith Radio is all about truffles and ticks. So, from savory all the way, way over to unsavory. First up, a whole new breed of Canadian fungus farmers. Truffles are an almost mythical European delicacy, but right now about 30 farmers in Ontario are about to bring that pungent delicacy closer to home. I speak with the man who started it all and to one of those would-be truffle growers. Next up, I chat with science journalist Vanessa Farnsworth about the serious subjects of ticks and Lyme disease. Vanessa suffered through a dreadful bout of the disease. We talk about that and whether or not climate change is making it more prevalent in Canada. So, settle in for the next half hour of Harrismith Radio. Adam Koziol used to be an ad man in Toronto. Then he and a friend got a crazy idea of growing mahogany trees with superpowered roots in the Caribbean. Over the years, that idea morphed into something even more fantastic, growing truffles from the roots of hazelnut and oak trees in Ontario. Working with Spanish scientists, Adam has inoculated young trees with the stuff that truffles are made from. He sold those trees to over 30 growers in Ontario who now are counting down the years to a possible truffle windfall. I visited Adam on his farm and the headquarters for EarthGen International near Dunnville, Ontario, to talk about his fantastic fungus factory. I think the story about the truffle starts with the Army Corps of Engineers, so tell me about that.
Well, that's how I got involved in the business. A friend of mine works for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and his job was to replenish the floodplains where the Mississippi and the Missouri rivers would flood out and wipe the vegetation out every year. They founded and developed this system of making trees grow a lot quicker, 3 to 5 times faster. Plus, they had the ability to be underwater for about a month without them dying, because with a massive root system, they're still bringing in oxygen from the water.
Right. Now, that's an air pruning system, right?
It's an air pruning system.
So tell me, just to quickly sort of explain what that is for folks.
Okay, air pruning is we let air kill off the tips of the roots. A tendency of any plant is the roots grow down. So with our trays and our timing process, when the roots go through the tray at the bottom, the air slowly kills off the tip, and that tells the plant that, wait, we can't send any more roots down. How about we go out? Right. So then they produce fibrous lateral roots.
So you've got this big root mass early in the growth of the tree, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So that makes the tree itself grow faster?
It does, because there's so much more carbohydrates being taken into the plant, as well as it probably sequesters 1,000 times more carbon than a bare root tree would, right, for example.
After the interview, Adam took me outside to one of his sheds on his farm. Inside were young hazelnut and oak trees sitting in giant pots. Like an Olympic weightlifter, he hefted a couple of the trees right out of the pots, roots, soil, and all, to show me the massive tangle of growth inside.
This is a truffle hazelnut tree. I keep these in a 21-gallon.
Right.
And the reason being is we're going to pull these guys up.
Right.
And I'll show you the root. See the roots?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And the same with this guy. Hold on. See how our system gives you feeder roots?
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. It's almost root bound there.
Yeah.
Now, I think you were originally going to do this with mahogany trees, is that right?
Well, that was the whole idea. It was going to be a retirement type of project. We're going to have me and this friend of mine that we're going to grow mahogany trees down in the Caribbean.
Right.
Because some of these trees go for $20,000 a tree.
Right. and time changes circumstances, and now you're up in Canada, and it's a solo business for you up in Canada, right?
It is, yeah. Right.
So, and now you're growing oak and hazelnut trees.
Well, with the truffles, yes. Yeah. Okay. And then we're also introducing stone pine, because that's another great one for truffles, as well as another product that could be a dual crop, because, you know, these pine nuts, they go for $50 a pound.
If I recall correctly, the truffles came because you were originally interested in growing these trees quickly, and I think for the nuts, the acorns and the hazelnuts and the pine nuts. But then you got in touch with some Spanish folks who were interested in the process, and they reciprocated with giving you information about truffle spores.
The Spanish scientists found out about our system, so they were interested, and they said, would you like to be interested in doing some truffles as well? This is about 5 years ago. So I go, of course. So we went down, met with them, and we developed a good relationship and a nice agreement. So I got the truffle inoculum from them. Okay, so there's a difference between truffle spores and an inoculum.
Okay.
Truffle inoculum is the highest quality that you can get, whereas a spore is you can just take the truffle or mushroom and grind it up yourself so that it has impurities, whereas the inoculum is certified and it's pure and it's a lot more and concentrated and a lot more potent.
Right. So let's talk about the truffles and the inoculum and the whole process. I assume there's a symbiotic relationship between the root mass for the hazelnuts or oak and the inoculum. And so that's one of the reasons that the Spanish were interested, because you've got this big root mass on the way you're doing them with the air pruning, right?
That's correct.
Right.
Because with our system, truffles, the inoculum, adheres at a very young stage to the roots. And with our system, it allows for that. And right off the bat, we have quite a few roots, and they're nice and white, so they just come out. And when you put the inoculum beside it, even, it's almost like a magnet, and the roots just draw to it.
So the truffles, I'm not sure of how they grow. The truffles aren't when they're in the ground and you've got mature trees. They're not growing on the root, but they're somehow associated with the root. Explain to me about
that. Okay, first, what happens is when we put the inoculum onto the roots, it creates a mycelium, okay,
right.
Just like any other mycorrhizas and that. And it takes, I just found out, about 4 years for it to develop this mycelium. And then it's going to develop into the truffle roots afterwards.
The mycelium are very, very tiny filaments, right?
It's like peach fuzz, yeah.
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 And that, so then the truffles themselves are the fruiting body of the fungus, is that
That's
right?
That's correct, yeah.
Right. So, but they're underground.
And it's underground and it's very specific. So we handle the burgundy truffle, as opposed to the black or even the Chinese or the white, because our climate will only handle the burgundy, because we want our season to be, well, between the middle of summer to the middle of December, let's say, because once the frost hits and the snow,
sure,
there's no way you can pick anything. Whereas in Europe, they have the black truffle or the white truffle, but their winters, there's no snow.
Right.
And it could be, you know, -4, -5 at the worst of times, but it's still in the daytime, it's 10, 15 degrees.
Right. And the other problem with the black and white truffles is they're coming from Italy, they're coming from France, and those guys didn't want to share their inoculum with you.
Not with me, no.
Yeah.
And that, it's very secretive.
Right.
Even the Spaniards, it's very secretive. Well, they wanted a special arrangement, an agreement, and it was very pricey.
Right.
So they weren't going to give out any secrets, but being a nurseryman, it wasn't very hard to figure out what they're doing.
Right.
And I figure we can still do it better.
Right. Cool. So now these days, you're selling these trees with the inoculum on them, and you've got, what, 30 growers in Ontario that have now got the trees?
Oh, at least now, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, and when were the first trees with the truffle inoculum put in the ground in Ontario?
The end of 2017.
Right.
That was our initial project, and just a few, there's about six sites that we did.
Right. So you've got another 2 years out before you hopefully we'll see some
on the first ones, yes.
Yeah. But it's a crapshoot, right? I mean, it could not work, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
But we figure, well, the way truffles the inoculum, the spores are quite aggressive.
Right.
Because once they take hold, they'll take over anything else as well.
Now, have you done any digging up of the roots of the trees that have been in the ground for 2 years to see what's happening down there?
No, we didn't dig those up yet, but I'm running an experiment. I got quite a few in 21-gallon pots, so they're about 2 feet wide by about 2 feet tall. So we're going to pull those out and analyze them as well. We've been analyzing them as we're going along as well underneath the microscope, because I came back from Spain and took a seminar that was more advanced now.
Right.
And they didn't have that before.
Right.
So we know that we're right on the right track.
Right. And I guess, too, even if they do produce the truffles, there's a gamble in terms of the terroir of whether it's going to be a good truffle or a truffle that, say, chefs in Ontario are going to be taken by, right?
Oh, it's going to depend on how the growers are treating their fields as well. I mean, if they're going to have a heavy clay compacted field, they're not going to have a yield or a very good yield, or it could be the size of a little pebble. But if they're going to till and make nice soft soil, they're going to have nice productive truffles, probably the size of a tennis ball.
So let's talk about that. Let's look at we were talking about the possible downside. Let's talk into the optimistic side. So suppose you've got, say, 100 trees planted, 100 hazelnuts or oak trees planted. What's going to be the potential yield in terms of volume and in terms of revenue coming out of that kind of crop?
Well, I'll give you an extreme example. One of the participants on the tour that I was in Spain in February is from Australia, and he's got a 50-acre plantation. So, and it's just hazelnuts and truffle inoculated ones, and that's 13,000 trees. His yield of the black truffle for 2018 was 6 tons.
Wow.
On an average of $1,000 Canadian a pound. And he expects 10 tons this year.
Wow, that's great. That's amazing.
So it's unbelievable.
Now, Australia is different than Ontario.
Yeah.
So what are you expecting in Ontario per acre, do you think?
It is so hard to say. We're going by the traditional rules that the Spaniards were going by. But the Australians just said, no, we got to rewrite all the books now. Like, the Australians are getting 400 or 500 pounds per acre. So if we get 200 pounds per acre, it's still going to be astronomical.
Right.
And the buying price, because the prices I'm quoting is what the dealers pay the farmer to buy. I don't know what they sell it for.
Right.
So, you know, there's a high market there. But I figure it a Burgundy truffle, because it's not as highly valued as the black, it's still going to be about $800 a pound.
In Australia, they're not using the air pruning system, right?
No, they're not.
So, and with the advantage of the air pruning system is you're going to get bigger root mass faster. Right.
Yeah.
So is your expectation that you're actually going to be able to produce truffles faster, or is it just going to be that there's more root mass earlier?
Well, I thought it would have been truffles faster, but the initial mycelium need, from what I heard of this last seminar, it needs that 4 years. But we're going to watch it closely. Could it be faster? I don't know.
Right.
And that, but we're going to have more roots to pick from as well.
Absolutely.
And this mycelium reproduces very quickly itself, right, as well. So
and the growers are optimistic?
Well, very optimistic.
Yeah, I talked to a couple in Guelph, and they're in for the long haul, right? They know they're in here for 4 years, but they're hopeful. And even if the truffles don't work out, they were saying that they've got the nuts, the hazelnuts.
They got the fallback with the hazelnuts.
So let's talk about that, because we talked about that early on, that there's an interest in acorns and hazelnuts and pine nuts, which are extremely valuable. So let's talk about acorns. What are you going to do with the acorns?
Well, the acorns, I'd like to set up a whole new industry as a feed for livestock, whether it's pigs. But the oak acorns are also edible by humans. I mean, in the olden days, humans used to live off of the acorns. So here we have great product, and it could be gluten-free, let's say flour for human consumption as well. So the potential is there.
And what about the hazelnuts themselves?
Oh, the hazelnuts. We're looking at non-dairy milk. We got people interested already. We got another customer that wants to buy it and resell. He's a wholesaler already, so he sells these big nut producers already, so they'll take everything we can produce.
So right, you're going to build a hazelnut consortium or a co-op or what?
We're planning to. Hopefully I get somebody interested that can take the lead in that, because I'm so busy with the growing aspect of it. Right now we joined the North American Truffle Association as well, so they're interested in us. There's another one for the truffles. I got somebody out of San Francisco wants to buy the truffles from our farmers on top of it. And then we have some Italians already interested.
And why would the Italians be interested?
Well, in Italy and actually even in Spain and France, they got a lot of contamination with the Chinese. Hmm. So a lot of counterfeiting going on. And just to give you an idea, Chinese, it probably goes for $30 a pound. So, and it's hard to track, so there's a lot of counterfeiting. Whereas over here, we won't have any of that contamination because we're doing a specific truffle, so to speak, and there's nothing imported yet.
Right. So we were talking about pigs and acorns. I want to talk about pigs and truffles and truffle hunting dogs as well. So in 2 more years, when the early adopters of the process start getting truffles, we hope, they're going to need to find those truffles. So tell me how that's going to work in Ontario, of people getting dogs and or pigs to find truffles.
Well, that's the thing. We will have to have dogs. You're not going to use a pig because, you know, the pig's going to go out there, eat all your truffles, and they're not going to run around on acres all day, whereas a dog can be light on their foot. Well, you'll have a hard time keeping up with a dog. Right. So they run a dog or work a dog in Spain for 2 hours at a time, because then you don't want them losing the scent of the truffle.
Right.
And they say one dog, you need 2 truffle hunters for. The dog's going to run, it smells, and it's going to scratch where the truffle is. So the hunters run up, and they get up, give the dog a reward, and then the dog runs off. So the one hunter's still digging where the truffles are, and the dog's already sniffing out another location.
So how deep down are the truffles? Like you said, the dog scratches. How deep do you have to go normally to get a truffle?
Okay, in the wild, it varies, and that doesn't go very deep, you know, no more than 10 inches. I've never seen it go past that. But on the plantations, you want to keep it down about 4 fingers depth, which is about 20 centimeters or so. So the sun doesn't scorch the ones that are coming to the top, and you keep your soil soft. So you're looking at about, you know, between 4 and 10 inches deep.
Adam isn't just a tree grower and seller of truffle inoculum. He's planning on being a nut and truffle farmer himself. So after he hefted those root balls in his greenhouse, he showed me around the rest of his farm.
So how many acres do you have here?
I have 60.
Wow.
So there's more planted last fall, last August.
So this, what we're looking at here, Adam, is your crop of hazelnuts and oak or on the back of your property.
And truffles and that. Where's my other first one? See, there's the other plantation there. Yeah. So there's no truffles in those.
Right, but these all have truffles.
Yeah.
So you're eating your own dog food here, right? Like you're actually planting and hoping to grow truffles yourself. So you're going to be one of the truffle farmers.
Oh, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Right. Oh, and for sure. Like what we do is, so when somebody comes and says, well, you know, you sold me this, and I want to know how they react.
So Adam, we talked about you spawning an interest in hazelnuts, in acorn for human consumption, selling the inoculate to farmers that wanted to create truffle farms and have hazelnuts and pine nuts for sale, as well as acorns. So you've got a whole industry going, but now you've got to deal with dogs. So how are you going to start the dog industry in Ontario for truffles?
Well, the dogs are very easy to train for this, because even some dogs that aren't trained for it, like the scientist that I had working on my truffle project from the University of Guelph, he took his dog, which is a 11-year-old border collie, for a walk around the woods, and it found the natural brown truffle that grows here. The dog just went, sniffed it, and then scratched.
Right, so it's a very pungent.
Oh, extremely.
So you've tried truffles yourselves, obviously.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So how would you describe the flavor to somebody who hasn't had a truffle, like a shaved truffle in the past or something?
Well, you have to like mushrooms first.
Right.
So it's a very strong, pungent mushroom smell.
Right.
And the taste, it's quite unique, but it's based along those lines.
Right. Now, I know some chefs in Toronto have used truffles from BC, right? And I can't remember if they're using Burgundy truffles from BC or not.
Probably BC has that native brown truffle as well, which goes from Oregon. So there's a whole industry out there that do it.
Now, have you talked to some chefs in Toronto or elsewhere in Ontario and saying, hey, you know, in a couple of years we may have these truffles. Are you guys interested?
Oh, yeah. They said, let me know as soon as you have them.
And you're obviously entrepreneurial. Are you going to set up a little restaurant here for folks to come and try?
I don't know if I want to get into the restaurant business.
Now, you started all this by wanting to grow mahogany trees in the Caribbean. How did you imagine that would turn out, and are you happier the way it's turned out now?
Well, there's a lot of struggles, but it's such a challenge and an adventure that I just love it.
That was Adam Kosial of EarthGen International, who's hoping to harvest truffles in Ontario any year now. Vanessa Farmsworth has had her life laid low by Lyme disease, so she knows all about its toll on health, happiness, and relationships. She also knows how ticks have been moving into Canada as unwanted invaders. She wrote about that in the spring issue of Harrismith magazine. I chatted with her about ticks and the complicated role climate change might play in their spread. Vanessa, thanks very much for joining us. I was really intrigued by your story about ticks, and I want to start off with the science. There's a personal aspect to ticks and to Lyme disease that I want to talk to you about, but let's talk about the science, because in the piece there was some debate about whether or not climate change was having an impact on the movement of ticks in Canada more northerly, right?
Oh, yeah, there's incredible debate over that.
What are some of the other reasons why ticks might be advancing northward?
Well, there's quite a few of them. Certainly one that we're looking at is critical mass being reached in the northeastern United States. And by that, I mean the environment can only sustain so many ticks in a certain area. And once you get too many ticks in that area, those ticks have to move out of that region into another region. So we're certainly seeing that. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why we're seeing this huge influx of ticks, particularly into eastern Canada, you know, Ontario eastward. We're seeing a huge number of ticks coming in for that reason.
Right. And into New Brunswick. One of the studies was done out of New Brunswick, right?
Yeah, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, those areas, really they're in a danger zone because of where they're located. Just on the U.S. side of the border, there are massive numbers of ticks in those areas, and they are pushing into the maritime provinces. Certainly Nova Scotia is seeing a big influx. We're seeing New Brunswick as well. And that is not going to go down. We're going to see those numbers go up over the years. We're seeing a general decline in biodiversity. You get things like ticks moving into these areas and just populating. Deer are on the increase in North America in general. And when you get that proliferation of deer, and we're also seeing a proliferation of mice as well, when you get those things happening, you're going to get a proliferation of ticks as well because they feed off of those creatures. Bird migration brings in extraordinary numbers of ticks. Up to 175 million are brought into Canada every year.
Right. Now, not all of those ticks are going to survive, but they're certainly an influx, right?
Well, that's true, and they're not going to survive, but that's where climate change really comes into this, because there are many regions in Canada that are warming to the point where ticks can survive, where they couldn't before. So 175 million ticks coming into Canada isn't in itself a bad thing, because nature will take care of that. You know, we're going to get the nice cold winters, and that is going to kill off the vast majority of those ticks. But what we're seeing now is warming in many regions where those ticks would have been killed off, and now they're not being killed off. If you live anywhere in Canada within 200 kilometers of the border with the United States, you can consider that at this moment you're living in an area that is endemic for black-legged ticks.
Now, I want to talk about why the tick infestation matters to you, because you struggled through Lyme disease, and you wrote a book a while back, Rain on a Distant Roof, A Personal Journey Through Lyme Disease in Canada. Tell me a bit about that.
It was actually two illnesses that I got from ticks at the same time. One was Lyme disease and the other was relapsing tick fever.
And what was it like for you to go through that? Yeah, I know you had seizures. What else was happening in your life?
Oh, yeah, it was absolutely horrendous. And sometimes, you know, I get a little scared about telling people, you know, what I went through, because I don't want people to think that Lyme disease is necessarily the worst disease on earth, even though that's how I experienced. Most people who contract Lyme disease, they're going to get, you know, a rash, flu-like symptoms. And if they know they've been exposed to ticks or could have been exposed to ticks, they can go to a doctor's office, get that diagnosed and treated right away, and they tend not to experience any of the more serious symptoms. Now, for me, of course, back in 2007, not only did I not know very much about Lyme disease, doctors did not know very much about Lyme disease. It wasn't something they expected to see in this country, and as a result of that, it took a very long time to get a diagnosis, and by the time it was diagnosed, for me, it was stage 3 neurological Lyme disease. So the Lyme disease had actually gotten into my central nervous system, it had gotten into my brain, and yeah, some really terrible things happened as a result of that. So you mentioned seizures, for sure, there was partial paralysis. There were just, you know, a lot of things that impacted my life in a way that were not great, and no ability to actually live a normal life. Now, that's an extreme example of what Lyme disease can do, but it is something that Lyme disease can do if it's not appropriately recognized. And this is something that we need to do a better job of in Canada is, you know, we learn when we get up in the morning to, you know, brush our teeth and wash our face, but we also have to learn as Canadians that when we come in from any time spent out in nature, we need to do tick checks and we need to look for those ticks and know whether there's a danger of exposure. That way, Canadians can get treatment before it turns into a neurological disaster.
Well, that's good advice, and thank you very much for sharing your story and sharing the story that you wrote in Harrismith magazine about tick migration in Canada. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Oh, thank you very much.
That was Vanessa Farnsworth, who is living happily and healthily today. Thanks, Vanessa. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harrismith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple, iTunes, or in your favorite podcast player. And please, tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harrismith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harrismith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harrismith Radio.